Om Namah Shivaya. Dear listeners of Shaivam.org, the next program is Spiritual Discourse. In this, you are about to listen Kawai Hindu Lectures. The titles are Serving Others, Gradual Progress, Next Generation, presented by Sri Shivaya Bodhiyada Velayada Swami. Thank you. Om Namah Shivaya.
Good morning, everyone. Today's Merging with Shiva lesson has to do with chakra cycles in each lifetime. The same cyclical pattern of development in human history is evident even more clearly in the growth of the individual. In the seven cycles of a man's life, beginning at the time of his birth, his awareness automatically flows through one of these chakras, and then the next one, then the next, and then the next, provided he lives a pure life following Sanatana Dharma under the guidance of a Sadguru. In reality, most people never make it into the higher four chakras, but instead regress back time and time again into the chakras of reason, instinctive will, memory, anger, fear, and jealousy. Nevertheless, the natural ideal pattern is as follows. From 1 to 7 years of age, man is in the Muladhara chakra. He is learning the basics of movement, language, and society, absorbing it all into an active memory. Patterns of his subconscious are established primarily in these early years. From 7 to 14, he is in the Svadhisthana chakra. He reasons, questions, and asks why. He wants to know how things work. He refines his ability to think for himself. Between 14 and 21, he comes into his willpower. He does not want to be told what to do by anyone. His personality gets strong. His likes and dislikes solidify. He is on his way now, an individual answerable to no one. Generally, about this time, he wants to run away from home and express himself. From 21 to 28, he begins assuming responsibilities and gaining a new perspective of himself and the world. Theoretically, he should be in Anahata, the chakra of cognition, but a lot of people never make it. They are still in the bull in the china shop consciousness, crashing their way through the world in the expression of will, asking why, reasoning things out, and recording it in memory patterns, which they go over year after year after year. But if awareness is mature and full, having incarnated many, many times, he goes on at 21 to 28 into the Anahata chakra. Here he begins to understand what it's all about. He comprehends his fellow men, their relationships, the world about him. He sees inwardly for more profound, he seeks inwardly for more profound insight. Chakra is stabilized and smoothly spinning once he has raised his family and performed his social duty, and though he may yet continue in business, he would find the energies withdrawing naturally into his chest. So that gives us a good insight into the pattern of the individual, as Gurudeva says. The same cyclical pattern development in human history is evident even more clearly in the growth of the individual. So clearly what we're seeking for is to get into the fourth chakra consciousness, Anahata. I like to think of it in the relationship to the Hume word Kamsatjamni. Gurudeva used to have a, which means overview, used to have a physical overview just to impress everyone. In the early days of his ministry, the first Sunday of every month, he'd drive up on the top of Mount Tamalpais with his devotees and look down into the city. So it was a physical Kamsachemni, just to make sure everyone got the idea. Nothing abstract about it. And it was interesting. I remember going a few times, and you would actually, by looking down on the city and the houses in the city, the cars driving around, you'd look down on your own life automatically. You'd be seeing the forest of your life instead of each individual tree. Normally, we know each individual tree so well, we know them on a first-name basis. All the details of our life, we're consumed by them. But we don't have an overview. We don't see patterns of action and reaction. We don't see patterns of frustration, patterns of opportunity. We don't see the patterns of our life because we just see each individual event as an isolated event, which we react to positively or negatively. But in Kamsachemni, we're seeing an overview. We start to see patterns in our life, both positive patterns, which we can expand upon, and negative patterns, which we can try and reduce. So the patterns become apparent. And going on top of a mountain is a nice way to do that, when you can look down on a city as that situation is, with philosophy encouraging you to do so. However, you can also do the same thing in your own mind, and the what keeps us from seeing the forest instead of the trees is our over-involvement in the chakras of memory, reason, and will. We're putting all our energy into that, and hopefully none below, into fear and anger. But we're so attached to what's going on, the memory of it, projecting into the future, the past. We're so busy in those chakras, we don't get up into the overview, which is the chest chakra. So Gurudeva has some nice material on that in the Shum. Which makes it, it gives a practical suggestion relating to the fourth chakra and the other higher chakras as well. It is good to locate the dimensions and distinguish them from Kamshumalinga. So Kamshumalinga is the Shum word for chakra. Kamshumalinga is the power of nymph, the power of awareness within the dimension itself. Look at each dimension through the area of the body where the Kamshumalinga exists. For example, when in Shumif, in the fourth dimension, try to look at the world through the chest. So we look at the world through the chest. That's what we're talking about. Kamsachemni is in that same dimension. When in the seventh dimension, try to look at the inner world through the top of the head. When in the fifth dimension, try to look out through the throat area. This is best done, of course, through Shumnam, and you will find that each Kamshumalinga relates directly to the third eye, and the third eye focuses through Kamshumalinga. So, Gurudeva will say this again, I think, later on, but it's an interesting idea. Usually we think that we're seeing through the chakra. But Gurudeva is saying, no, your third eye is seeing through the chakra. Every time you see something inside yourself, you're utilizing your third eye. You're just pointing it into a different part of the inner you. This is best done, of course, through Shumnam, and you will find that each Kamshumalinga relates directly to the third eye, and the third eye focuses through Kamshumalinga. In the very same way, you can close your physical eyes and feel with your fingers a table or something soft or something hard. You're actually seeing through your fingers. And the other senses work in this way too. This is how the Kamshumalinga work, so distinguish them as different from the dimensions. Then there's another quote which says the same thing, slightly differently. We always have to remember to be aware of where a Shum portrait is. For six-dimensional portraits, you should look out from between the eyes, whereas for fifth-dimensional portraits, you should look out from the throat area. For a fourth-dimensional portrait, you should look out from the chest area because it is Shumif. If we start looking at the world through Bivumbika Kamshumalinga or Remche Na or Renamche Vum Kamshumalinga, the world looks very different, and that's the Mulif perspective, philosophical perspective or intellectual perspective. Elsewhere, Gurudeva states that it is the first three Kamshumalinga that relate to the third dimension. So then there's an exercise. We did this on the inner search, looking out through the different Kamshumalinga to try and experience the dimension. So we won't do that this morning and take too long. There's a good write-up, short write-up, compared to the full material available on the dimensions in the meditation book. So I thought I'd just read the third and the fourth, because what we're trying to do is distinguish the fourth from the third. That's what the point of what I'm focusing on is. What's the difference between the fourth dimension, seeing the forest instead of the trees, or the third dimension, seeing the trees and not the forest? It is in the third dimension that most people live most of the time. This is the world of thoughts and feelings, of emotions and intellectual theory. Within the changing world of the third dimension are two basic and intricate energy flows. The first is a flow of force between people and things. This is a one-way flow through which people relate to objects. The second is a flow between two people or more, and also between people and animals. Visualize a stream of energy generated in the body by the process of life. This energy or prana constantly flows out from the central source of energy and constitutes the aura, constitutes the physical energy that moves the body, constitutes thoughts and feelings. This prana creates a force field around the body. As soon as two people associate, these force fields interacts, or the two energy streams interchange. Should these energies be of a like nature, the result is a friendship. When we understand these energies as they combine, attract, and repel in human relationships, we then begin to discover the constituent parts of what we call the world. That's why it's very important that relationships with others are harmonious, because we get stuck when they're not. Our awareness gets stuck. We can't get it out of that area of the mind. Can't get it out of that energy. When our energy is negative with someone else, it binds our awareness in the third dimension. So we need to harmonize the relationship, at least on our side. Sometimes we can't harmonize it on both sides, but at least harmonize it on our side to get unstuck. And then our awareness can get out of the third dimension and go deeper. Otherwise, we're stuck, we're externalized because of inharmonious condition with one or more people. Fourth dimension. From the vantage point of the fourth dimension, we can view the building of emotional involvements within the third dimension, observing the workings of the emotional and intellectual units of ourselves and others. From this detachment, we gain the ability to dissolve confusions, conflicts, and the various and varied entanglements that are encountered daily. We want to dissolve them. The negative ones. In the fourth dimension, the first glimmer of inner light within the head is seen. It is usually a pale, moon-like glow seen at the top of the head. This dimension gives us a mountaintop consciousness. It's That's what we were talking about before, Kamsatchimni, that looks over, in, and through everything and gives the facility to enjoy and participate fully in the world while knowing at all times exactly where we are in the mind. Artists are in the fourth dimension. Each time you design or created anything, you are bringing the beauty of the within through your nerve system into manifestation. It is a beautiful place to be, and you can be there all of the time, this is the key, by feeling the power of your spine. The minute you feel that radiant energy in the spine, you are disconnected from the third dimension and soar into the fourth. So that's a very simple way of getting into the fourth dimension, but it only works if we're not tied up in negative energy relationships with others or conflict. If we have significant conflicts going on, then we can't do that. We won't be able to feel the energy in the spine. So those are some interesting thoughts on the fourth chakra and the fourth dimension, and trying to identify them more clearly, shall we say, and utilize them more frequently in our life. And it's very important that we have an overview of what's going on in our life, in our mind, in our emotions, because having an overview, we're able to direct it more productively, avoid certain problem areas and develop certain positive areas more effectively because we have an overview. Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. Two items this morning. First one is from today's Living with Shiva lesson. It's on importance of harmony and resolving inharmonious conditions. Thought I'd read just a couple of lines. There is no group of people on earth for whom living in harmony is not a challenge at one time or another. That make you feel better? Nobody exists where it's not a challenge at one time or another, living in harmony. But it is true that among my devotees we have zero tolerance for disharmonious conditions of any kind. One of the principles of harmony is that commitment to harmony has to be greater than any commitment to any particular issue or problem. Problems change, but the strength of harmony has to be the ultimate priority. This is a conceptual tool to use when differences arise. In other words, sometimes when we're passionate about something, we place being right above being harmonious. We place our opinion and the success of our opinion in being accepted as being more important than being harmonious. So Gurudev is saying that it's not wise to do that. That's having those priorities, that having your opinion accepted is more important than maintaining harmony, can easily lead to an inharmonious condition. So what Gurudev is saying is we have to maintain harmony, and then we can only have discussions and present opinions in a way that maintains that harmony. Otherwise our priorities are reversed, or our priorities are externalized. You may recall we were talking a few weeks ago about intuition, and we've developed a keynote/PowerPoint presentation on intuition based upon Gurudeva's book, the book on Gurudeva's visions. And I shared part of it, which was the idea of tapping intuition, how to tap intuition, and that Gurudeva gives a key for that process in cognizant ability, which has to do with observation. We can identify that part of us which has an intuitive thought if we're observant, and we can cultivate the ability to be observant, you remember, by abstinence from excessive talk. Talking too much causes the mind to chatter too much. In other words, externally talking stimulates internal thinking or unnecessary chatter, and that covers up or makes it hard to identify an intuition when one comes to us. Intuition comes to everyone, particularly in times of danger, times when something's very important. Intuition comes to everyone, but we don't identify it as intuition because there's not enough observation going on in the mind to know that that's an intuition versus that's a memory or that's a guess. So we're getting a wonderful resource. It's called the Guru Book, Line of Guru Book, and I tried it and it worked. I looked up something and I found it and came up with a whole story that I wouldn't have had. I had two lines in my notes, my 1972 notebook from Olivetti that said, something like this was all I had, and you'll see how it gets beautifully developed in the story. Yogaswami was standing at the corner. Car came up. He said no orders and didn't get in. Car came back. He said, I've got my orders, and he got in. Something like that. That's my note. That's all I've got. So you can see how this comes up beautifully in this story. Yogaswami worked intuitively, responding to those who came according to inner orders. In explaining this process, he once said, I do nothing, I can do nothing. Everything you see, that is done by what comes from within. Another time he said, when you come here, what will happen was settled long ago. We go through it. You bring it, but it all happened long ago. Sit and be a witness. He advised, boldly act when you receive orders from within. You need not wait until all details are in order. If you wait for everything to be worked out, you may miss your chance. Have faith and do the work that comes from within. Money will trail after you if you are responding to divine orders. Helpers will come. Everything will come. You have only to follow carefully that which comes from within. When asked how to find one's inner voice, he said, Sumairu, be still. Be still and what you need will come to you. Sumairu was his constant command. He practiced it and heeded the answers that came. Someone would ask him a question and he would wait to feel his orders. If he felt no orders, he would do nothing until orders came. Once a man drove up to Swami as he was walking through town and asked if he could drive him anywhere. No orders, Swami replied, and waved the man on. A few minutes later, the driver came by and stopped again. Now I have my orders, Swami said, and got into the car. That's the story. Much nicer than the version I had before. car not getting in and car getting in. Of course, what can we see from this? That Gurudeva and Yogaswami's advice on how to find one's intuition is the same, it's just the wording is different. Gurudeva is saying abstinence from excessive talk. Yogaswami is saying be still. Same thing, right? When do you tell a child to be still? Well, one of the reasons is talking too much, making too much noise. So, give it a try. The results may surprise you. Have a wonderful day.
Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu, Guru Devo Maheshwara, Guru Sakshat Parabrahma, Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Good evening, everyone. Nice to have so many of guests this evening joining us for Mahashivaratri. Gurudeva gives us a description in Dancing with Shiva of Mahashivaratri. He says we observe it by chanting Shiva's names, singing his praise, chanting Sri Rudram, bathing the Shiva Lingam. So these are activities common to all temples that celebrate Mahashivaratri. Gurudeva adds two more activities, which are meditating. You don't see a lot of that. Temples. And being near the monks. Definitely that doesn't happen at temples. As they strive to realize Parashiva, the transcendent aspect of God. So that's what we're doing here, and also at other monasteries and ashrams in India, they do a similar practice. So stated simply, the essence of the celebration of Mahashivaratri is to have a deeper experience of God Shiva than is normally available to us. I have a story. We met a very fine family in the Gurupeetam where you watch the TV. Hindu couple living in Los Angeles, and their family tradition is from Kashmir, and as many of those from Kashmir have done, they moved out because of the problems there and moved to Delhi and then moved on to Los Angeles. So they were telling about their tradition, and we had a wonderful talk, and so many similarities between what they did and what we do. They said that their form of worship was quite different from general Hindus, as the only deity they worshipped was Shiva. Imagine that. Didn't even worship Ganesha or Murugan, only Shiva. And the only festival they celebrated was Mahashivaratri. That was it. Which they celebrated as the marriage of Shiva and Shakti. So I was doing a little research on Kashmir Shaivism, and it's strongly monistic, meaning talking about the identity of man and God. And we can get a sense of this from some of the statements by the last preceptor in the lineage, passed on not too long ago, Swami Lakshman Ju. And we wrote an article about him in a 1991 Hinduism Today. So I'm going to quote from it. He uses the term Bhairav to refer to Shiva. So when he says Bhairav, you just think of Shiva. So the article states, often Swami speaks from a point of reference of being Shiva. Then quoting Swami, I am Bhairav, and the entire world is my offshoot, he exclaims. Shiva is the only great God, and all others are his manifestations. God is the inner being. The entire world is his external being. Unquote. Article continues, with these three tight statements, he has summed up the enlightened mind of Kashmir Saivism, including his personal identity as Shiva. This monism is such a bedrock state that he forecasts, quoting Swami, the religions that do not believe in oneness will vanish, he says. That's an interesting thought to ponder. The religions that do not believe in oneness will vanish, is his prophecy. So, of course, we usually don't think of Mahashivratri as the marriage of Shiva and Shakti. So I was giving that some thought, the Shiva-Shakti concept. In many temples, Shakti is a separate murti, giving the sense that Shiva and Shakti are separate beings. And I don't know how often that happens now, but it used to be regularly visiting Hindus would say, where is Shakti? You know, there's Shiva, where's Shakti? How can you have Shiva and not have Shakti? So, of course, we say, well, Shiva and Shakti, it's right here as Ardhanarishvara, right in the corner there. And then we go through the explanation of that. So even though Hindus expect Shiva and Shakti as separate murtis, many philosophically understand that they're not separate. There's many verses on that. There's a nice one in Arumuga Navalar's Saiva Vinavidai. He asks the question, what is the Shakti of Shiva? And the answer, the power of Shiva, which is inseparable from Shiva, like the heat of fire, which is inseparable from fire. Well, that's the common comparison. Fire gives off heat, which is a form of energy. If there's no fire, there's no heat. And you can't separate the two. The energy produced by the fire and the fire are really a one reality. A term that encompasses this idea is Shiva-Shakti. When it's hyphenated, it makes it a one word. So our lexicon definition is Father, Mother, God, both eminent and transcendent, and then the point we're talking about, a name for God Shiva encompassing his unmanifest being and manifest energy. So both, the being and the energy. So, looking at how the Shiva-Shakti concept applies to man, man is a soul and is radiating a variety of energies or pranas. The normal direction of prana is outward. However, in yoga, through the practice of pranayama, which simply means the control of prana, we can cause the energies to flow inward. And when we manage to withdraw energy back to its source, or Parashiva, then the realization of Parashiva, the self-God, is achieved. In other words, this could be one of the mystical interpretations of the concept of the marriage of Shiva and Shakti, that energy, Shakti, has united with its source, Shiva. And when that happens, then you have self-realization. So fortunately, Gurudeva has explained this much better than I can. Wonderful quote from him here. The mission is, that's what he calls it, the mission is, don't go any place. Turn awareness back in on itself and simply be aware that you are aware. Become conscious of energy within the physical body and the inner bodies flowing out through the nerve system and drawing forth energy from the central source of the universe itself. Now try to throw awareness into this central source of energy and dive deeper and deeper in. Each time you become aware of something in the energy realm, be aware of being aware. Finally, you go beyond light, Finally, you go into the core of existence itself, the self-God, beyond the stillness of the inner areas of the mind. That is the mission, and that is what humanity is seeking, total self-God realization. So, saying source of the energy is another description of Shiva or Parashiva. We have the energy and the source of the energy. So when the energy is withdrawn into the source alone remains, or we have self-realization. Thank you very much.